Welcome to the Scary Dad Podcast. This is episode 146, and as you heard from the little music at the beginning, this is a special episode. This isn't a Billy and Scott talking about scary things. This is a special guest episode.
Ooh, special.
That's it. We've got author Jessica Rainey on. Big friend of the show, has been with us since year one of the Scary Dad Haunted Halloween show. She has been with us for all 3 years. She's going to be in year three. She's going to be selling books and running a couple of different panels. And she's been instrumental behind the scenes setting up all of the programming on our literature side. So all of these great artists and authors and panelists that you're seeing, she has been bringing those to the fore to make sure that we have a wonderful entertainment lineup for you guys. And she's also got a book about to come out, so we thought we'd sit down and talk about the book release. So that's pretty much it for an introduction. How have you been?
Awesome. Thanks for having me on. I am always excited to be on a podcast. I did one for about a year with some guys, and I miss it occasionally. I don't miss all the crazy work that it was. It was a lot of work. But I do miss recording every once in a while. I get that little itch. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. We try to make it as work-free as possible. It's like if we both have to watch a movie, if at least one of us watched it, we're like, okay, that's probably good.
Yeah. I know I have an exact situation coming up, so I understand that.
So tell us about the new book, or if you want to talk about some of your old books, because you've got quite a few in the hopper.
I do. It's kind of a funny thing. I never thought I would have this many books, and it's been a lot of books in a short time span too, so... I have 6 books and 3 of them are short story collections. So I kind of started out, that's where I cut my teeth, was writing the short stories, and I never knew exactly what I would do with them. I thought, well, I'll, you know, try to get them in magazines or anthologies or journals and all that. That's a tough gig. And I write weird stuff. Like I would write it and it really didn't go anywhere. It wasn't hard horror and it wasn't not horror, so it was weird to put it places. So I did my first collection, and I always say that it's like the Twilight Zone. Like if you binge watch the old Twilight Zone, that's kind of what it's like. And then I have my second short story collection was a similar thing. You know, I thought I got better at short stories and I had more stuff, and I'd revisited some old things and kind of, you know, made them a little bit better and more interesting. So I had that. And then I started writing novels, and I didn't ever think I could write a full novel because it was really tough. I don't know, you know, you know how it is. Like writing a short story and making that coherent is pretty tough, but at least you have a concise place to do it in, and you got your beginning, middle, and end. And it didn't feel like I could ever do that like big scale with a novel. I always got stuck in the plot and like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that? And really, that's the fun of it, right? You're solving a problem. And that's the fun of a novel. So I wrote the novel. And the novel, you know, it came out of what I thought would have been a short story, a really long one, but I was able to kind of like make it longer. And it's called Tooth and Nail. And I call it Hillbilly Supernatural Noir is what the genre I always say it is. So it's a werewolf story, but because it's told from the point of view of the werewolf, you never see anything but the after effects of a werewolf. So in the first book, I was never able to do like the transformation or anything like somebody watching a werewolf eat somebody or something like that. It was always like the werewolf wakes up and they've done something terrible. But it's set in Appalachia, which is actually where I'm from. I'm from a little tiny town called Marietta, Ohio. It's right on the Ohio River on the border with West Virginia. So, you know, I guess I might as well be a West Virginian, which to some people would be offensive. They're like, yeah, I'm not a West Virginian. But anyway, so like that's where I'm from. And it's a weird place. Like it's a spooky, It's a river valley, so nothing goes out. You know, you have a tough time getting out of that area, and people don't understand that if you've never been in an area like that, especially people down here in Texas that are, you know, around Houston, a huge city. Like, getting out of these small towns here is easier because you just moved to Houston, but getting out of those little right. small towns in these pockets of America is really difficult. So, you know, that's part of the story. That's part of the horror of the story for me, is being stuck and being, you know, kind of in this place you can't get out of. So that book, it came together well, and I was happy with it. And everybody was like, well, are you going to write more? That's a series. You have to write more. You have to write more. And I was like, yeah, eventually I will. I don't know. And in between there, I wrote a zombie apocalypse story, which is kind of like Indiana Jones and zombies. So that was a fun one. Yeah, it's fun. It's called These Violent Delights. And I love a good zombie story, so that's my horror zombie novel. But it's quirky and fun, and every chapter kind of ends with them in a jam, and then they got to get out of the jam. So it really reminded me of like an old school radio play, or like, you know, like an episode of Indiana Jones, like in Temple of Doom, when they're trying to get out of all their jams and stuff, and they just get into the next jam. So that's what it is with zombies. And then I wrote a collection with Jay Mazur, so we teamed up and wrote a short story collection, which is really fun. I'm really proud of that one. That has some really awesome stories by both of us in it, and I love that book. It's called Tales from the Den. And then my last book here is going to be the sequel to Tooth and Nail, and it's called The Hard Truth. But it's not exactly a sequel. It's playing around in the same world, and I really wanted to do that. Okay. It's a continuation of the book, but from a different main character's point of view, and in a kind of a different, completely different story. It's horror, and it's a kind of superhero story, and it's a what if story, like what if these powers were real and what if I could do this. So I'm excited for it to come out, and I hope that it satisfies the people that really like Tooth and Nail and love that world, and that it also satisfies, you know, people who maybe hadn't read Tooth and Nail but want to read something else. You know, I was able to make it a little bit longer, and it's a more complicated story, which second novels almost always are, and because you kind of got your feet wet with the first one. So hopefully it comes out well. I love it. Beta reader has been positive, so positive feedback, and we'll see. Comes out October 4th. October 3rd. October 3rd, and then we'll go from there. We're trying to figure out where to do a party or release party. I'm thinking an Applebee's, because that's kind of where the critical part of the story takes place. So I got to find an Applebee's in Houston.
See if they'll let them sponsor you.
Yeah, I should.
Well, awesome. That is a very respectable body of work there in such a short time. I think the last time we talked, you were, I think you were just either on Dreadful Pennies. So yeah. You've added quite a bit to your resume in a very short period of time, just like about a year and a half.
That's... Yeah, you know, thank NaNoWriMo, I guess. I don't know. I'm of two minds always about that, like whether it's really a good thing or a bad thing. But it has been good in that I did produce a lot of stuff. So that was positive.
See, that always... I always see people doing a wonderful, amazing things on the NaNoWriMo. I never participate because usually around that time is I've got like 8 other projects and writing projects. Like I do a lot of short story writing. I write for anthologies, and not to talk about me versus talking about you because you're the guest, but like I did a whole bunch of work in 2018 that I didn't get hardly anything published in 2018, but everything I did in 2018 hit in like the first 4 months of 2019. And so then my wife's giving me a hard time. She's like, man, you really kind of fell off that writing boat, didn't you? And I was like, what are you talking about? I had a book come out every month this year. And but a lot of that was in the nano projects, people were doing it like, oh, hey, I want to do an anthology. Can we all get together and write at least one short story and put a book together in a month, and those sorts of things. So usually I've got my time committed to it. So I've never sat down to try to actually do the word count and do a novel, but I do know it works for people. So, That's National Novel Writing Month. And when is that, November normally?
Yeah, it's November. You know, I'm of two minds of it. So I like the challenge. I had never actually completed a nano until last year. I got the 50,000 plus words last year, but I think it's good and bad. So it's great that it gives you a daily writing habit, because if you really want to produce, that's what you really have to do. You have to dedicate some time to it and write, you know, as much as you can whenever you can. But I don't know that it's helpful to me and that it makes me like anxious. So it gives me anxiety and that kind of stuff. I never like that part of it. But if you use it correctly, I think it's a really useful month. But, you know, something always goes down in November. Like one November I bought a house and I just didn't have time to do it. One November, I don't remember what happened, but like there, it was always an obstacle. And last November there was even obstacles, like, you know, but it didn't stop me from doing it. I still stayed focused on it. So it's good and bad. It gives you, you know, production, but at what cost? You know, you're kind of tired and wiped out and maybe burn out by the end of the month. That's kind of bad. I don't like being burnt out on writing. So,
right. Well, having gone from short stories to the novel, I guess for an aspiring writer, kind of is like me, like I have a tendency to write. I write long, short stories. So I'll write in the, you know, 10 to 15,000 word on average short story that's extremely detailed, multiple characters, lots of layers, and it usually could be a multiple start part story if I want to go back and write a sequel or a third part. So going from that sort of, you know, I guess process, what would you recommend for somebody who's good at writing short stories but not so much, maybe not say attention span's not the right word, but I kind of have a tendency to wrap it up. Like there's not a whole lot more to tell. And then when I go back and reread it, I'm like, man, that was really wordy. So it's not only is it relatively concise, it's also thick. So,
no, I do that too. I write a short story and I think, okay, I'm done with this. I'm moving on to the next one. And when I write the book, you know, I just have to, it's just got to be a little bit bigger of a story and you have to do more character building. You know, you want to focus on the little, like a chapter or a scene that tells us something about your character and that still moves your plot forward. I mean, you don't want people getting bogged down, but you do want them, you know, to be invested in the character, and you can do that in a longer way in a novel than you can in a short story. You have to be really economical in a short story because you still have to do it. Mm-hmm. You have to care about the character or else even a short story sucks. But in a novel, I feel like, you know, I just focus on taking it to certain points by certain chapters, and not everybody does it that way. Everybody does it totally different. I kind of like that save the cat method, but I don't exactly follow that either. You know, I just try to think about a movie. I try to think, honest to goodness, I think about Star Wars a lot and how that arc, I think about how the arc of the story goes. Like you know, you introduce your characters, you introduce your world, you spend time on that. So in Star Wars, you know, you're introduced to the characters and the world and the world building, and you're in the Mos Eisley cantina and you're seeing all these crazy aliens, and the problem is introduced. And then when the problem's introduced, you spend some time like, okay, how am I going to solve this problem? Maybe I didn't solve it right the first time and I have a couple false starts, but then you start the action and you get them moving. And I honestly, I write horror stuff and I write adventure-y type stuff. I mean, the zombie book that I have is, it's really just an adventure story, but it's kind of overarching. I had a plan in mind when I wrote it about maybe saying something about the world and economics and the way that we run our societies. And so I tried to do that. And that's a lot to say. Like, I kind of feel like I'm rambling about that, but that's what novels do. Like, you want to explore the world and give people a glimpse into it. But like I said, I just always kind of keep a movie in mind. Like, well, how does a movie work? A book should kind of work the same way in my mind. Because when I'm reading a book that I love, it's like I'm seeing a movie in my head. And that's how I write
it. Exactly.
So it's the same for me. So just, you know, people should have a character people care about. Actually, I watched a cool video by Elmore Leonard, the writer. And he talked about, he doesn't really worry about plot. He starts with a cool character that talks to him. And then he can get that character talking and can hear the character speaking. And, you know, that's what they, he starts with. And if you care about this character and that character is awesome, then the plot follows. The plot is just automatic from that character. And I can see him writing that way, because I don't know, you know, the thing probably a lot of people know is the Raylan Givens, the Justified TV series, that's an Elmore mm-hmm. Leonard novel. And, you know, Raylan Givens has a very distinct voice, and you can, he's going to drive the plot. The character is going to drive the plot. So I kind of like that aspect of it.
Yeah, I always find, I read a lot of Stephen King. And, you know, obviously most people have read a lot of Stephen King, but I've always found, especially when it came to writing advice, and that's why I pretty much ask everybody that I know, if I'm in a position to ask and we're really able to have a conversation about it, I ask everybody I know kind of like, what's your process? Like, what do you do? Because I come at it almost from like a Stephen King standpoint, where he's like, okay, so, you know, what if there was a monster in the lake? Like, what if some vampires moved into a small New England town and nobody believed in vampires? Like, how long would it take before the contagion spread, before they, you know, nobody was left? Like, just to have that kind of idea, like, okay, well, what if? And so one of the stories that I've written that was very well received was this one called Seeker. And it was a long, short story. But it came from a position of, okay, so back in the 80s during the Satanic Panic, when everybody was against heavy metal and Dungeons and Dragons, I thought, okay, well, what if all of that was real, but they were like, Dungeons and Dragons was just mainstream. Dungeons and Dragons was the safe one, but there was this one over here that if you got involved with it was actually dangerous. Like, you could actually conjure demons with it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, what would that be like? You know, and I wrote that story, and like, as I'm writing it, I want to see, I want to find out. And so rather than actually writing a story, developing characters, they woke themselves up. Like, I'm describing this relationship between these two teenagers, and like, I hadn't even thought about what the girl looked like until she pushed her hair over her ear. And then I'm like, oh, okay. And then she's got a little button nose, and it's like, I can just see her in my head. She's no longer like a character description, she's a person.
Yeah.
And that was really, writing that story was kind of the first time that had ever happened, and I spend every other story attempting to make it happen. I'm usually pretty successful. Because it's so easy to sit there and somebody show you a picture and be like, okay, describe that person. And you're like, okay, well, he's tall, he's got long hair, he's got glasses, he's wearing a Jaws t-shirt. Versus, okay, to come up whole cloth with somebody and you're like, okay, he's a college student, I guess, you know, like,
yeah,
it's easier if they just reveal themselves to you. And so that's really kind of the way that I think about it. And like you said, with movies, it's funny that you mentioned Star Wars, cause I'm original trilogy loyal. I'm not big on the prequels at all, but, I kind of the same thing with pacing. It's like, okay, well, what makes these characters so well loved? And it's the way that they talk, and it's the way that they act around each other.
I mean, you know, episode, you know, 4, so A New Hope is not the best example of that, but like The Empire Strikes Back is one of the best examples of like movie dialogue and a relationship that's happened off camera and between the time like Star Wars ends and Empire Strikes Back starts. Like, there's stuff that's going on that you don't know about, and you can tell it. They act like it, and the dialogue informs it, and the way the characters bounce off of each other. I mean, Han and Leia's banter back and forth, like, you know, that's been going on for however long they've been hopping planet to planet and, you know, rebel base to rebel base. So it's really interesting. And I think Empire Strikes Back is my favorite Star Wars movie.
That's because it's the best one.
It is because that's the best one. And I mean, you know, it's the actors are clearly like having fun with what they're doing. I mean, it's the Han Solo and the Princess Leia relationship. It's the problem that they put them in. So the problem they put them in is a really awesome problem with, you know, my ship's broken down, I got to get away. You know, they're moving from one problem to another and solving them. And I always can take the Dagobah stuff or leave it. I'm like, ugh, Luke Skywalker bores me. So I don't actually care about that too much, except for it's really central to everything. I mean, you have to, you know, you have to have that happen for the rest of the plot. But I mean, to me, like on the Falcon trying to get away from Darth Vader, is my favorite part of any Star Wars movie ever. I mean, I love the final battle on the Death Star in Return of the Jedi. That's an awesome lightsaber battle. And the battle, like, I know you don't like prequels, but the Duel of the Fates with Darth Maul is a badass, you know, that's a badass battle. That's it though. That movie's kind of crappy. Scene,
like the movies themselves, like, and I don't know if you heard that episode where I was with Johnny Stitches and he was talking about his favorite Star Wars. And I'm like, oh yeah, I could barely get through those, the Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith. He's like, oh no, that battle between Kenobi and Vader on Mustafar. And I went back and I watched it up and I was just like, I can't. It's like,
it's the bad like acting. And bad dialogue. Acting,
but also they're at the bottom of a volcano. It's like, dude, you realize you would have been completely vaporized like 100 feet in the air.
Yeah.
And you're surfing on lava. Like, I can suspend a lot of disbelief about like laser swords and people breathing in space, but that is bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they go to, I'll say this for Star Wars, you know, I always think it's more fantasy than sci-fi. Like sci-fi never lets you get away with stuff like that. Cause you know, when I started out, here in Houston writing, I went to a horror writers meetup and they still meet. Hopefully you're, I think my cat just activated the TV, so I'm going to have to kill him.
That's hilarious.
I hate that cat. he's like sitting on the sound bar and he turns it on and then like the Texans game's blaring in my face. So yeah, you can suspend a lot of disbelief for that, but sci-fi guys will never let you live that stuff down. When I started out, I was in a critique group and most of them were sci-fi writers, like hard sci-fi writers. And if you didn't describe a table to the centimeter, they would be like, you didn't describe the table enough. I don't know how many centimeters wide it was. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. So they like for you to get your science right. And that's great. Like that really helped me out, in writing stuff like that. But you know, cause I like to write monsters and ghosts and weird stuff. Like, I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to tell you why stuff happens. I don't want to explain zombie infections. I just want there to be zombies. Like just let there be zombies. And I don't really care why, you know, you have to have a problem.
You can describe with a few words to just get it through too, with a little minimum of exhibition.
Yep.
That's not necessarily, you don't have to know the science or the, like the biology behind it, but you know, have you ever read, Maxwell Brooks, the Zombie Survival Guide, or no, World War Z.
Yeah. World War Z is my favorite zombie book of all time. Absolutely. So
you knew where it came from. You knew where the plague began. You knew all of the science and everything, except for you never actually got science. Like a kid came out of the lake with a cut on his foot. Yeah. Boom. Like is the plague in the water? Is the plague in, you know, like there was still mystery there, but you knew enough about it that it set itself solidly in the real world where, you know, same thing with like Ebola. People are going like, oh, we don't know what it is. You know, it just started happening and people get fevers and a couple days later they explode and you're like, whoa, that sounds like something out of a horror novel. It doesn't sound like it's real, but it is, you know, and.
Yeah. Ebola is so terrifying. Yeah. You know, all those diseases like that, hemorrhagic fevers are super terrifying because you don't know how I'm going to stop it, you know? And I think that's why zombie things are fun. At least the iteration that we're in now with the infection-y type stuff is, you know, how do we stop it? How do we prevent it from happening to me? And I think that's interesting. And a lot of people like the societal breakdown stuff. I do too. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, I'm like, well, what if I didn't have to go to work tomorrow and I could just do whatever I wanted? That would be great. Except I would be in the apocalypse and it might not be that much fun. Cause I now have to figure out how to like eat when I don't have the HEB to go to anymore. So that part wouldn't be that fun.
I think that's funny too, because there's so many of the hobbyists, like the hobbyist survivalists and stuff. I fell in years ago. I fell into, it was after Walking Dead came out and I was like living in Hurricane Alley. I was like, okay, I need to know a little bit more about just general disaster preparedness, sort of like not zombie apocalypse, but just like, you know.
Right. How to survive for a couple of weeks, like just a couple of weeks, right. How you would go about your life.
So I found this, the show, it's a survival, it's called the Survival Podcast. And this dude, he does an hour long show every day for like the last 12 years on all kinds of subjects, but he's not a kook. Like it's all common sense, practical stuff. But I mean, he does like homesteading, hunting, like gardening, orchard planning, fishing, you know, just all kinds of stuff. And then, but he'll sit there and be like, okay, so like disaster prep. He's like, here's the funny thing. He's like, all these people that are worried about they want the world to come to an end because then it'll be like, he's like, dude, if you're not making it like, okay, whenever all the power's on, you're going to have a real hard time when it's off.
Yeah.
Like points that out and you're like, yeah, I'd probably do all right in the winter, but as soon as the summer came, I'd be screwed.
Exactly. Like, what are your life skills that you bring to the apocalypse? So, I mean, I worked with this dude and he was a hunter. He was a trapper. He wanted to raise tilapia in his garage to see if he could do it. I mean, he had like a plan. I wouldn't call him a prepper or anything because he wasn't crazy, but he had so many skills. Like, I wanted that many life skills. What life skills do I have? Like, I would probably hit somebody with a rock and take their stuff. Maybe. I don't know what my skills would be like, but, you know, kind of, I thought the same thing, like, well, how do I get some more skills? I mean, I grew up in a rural neighborhood, you know, we had gardens. So if I have to, yeah, I can grow crops. Yeah. I can, you know, I could kill stuff if I had to survive, but like, I don't really want to do stuff like that. But I do like, I like survival shows. I like the idea of testing myself, but I don't like being bitten by bugs or being too hot. So that's right. Kind of lets me out on the naked and afraid stuff. Also, I don't want to be naked, but I mean, like that lets right. me out, you know, I'm like, I can't do any of that stuff. Cause I just don't want to be bitten by bugs. Anybody that's lived in the Gulf Coast and you have like 9 billion mosquitoes, like you just can't deal with it. So I don't know how people deal with that on those shows, but they're fun to watch. And I think that is very American of us. You know, we're Americans always have been like pioneer type people, or they see themselves that way. And so that's always like, can I test myself? I'm an independent person. I can survive. I can do this. And, you know, my great, great, great grandpa, you know, came from the hills of Kentucky out west and he made it, and I'm sure I could do it. I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. Like, I get mad when the internet goes out for 10 minutes. So I yeah. don't know if I could do it. I probably would. I'd be fine. But you know, I'm definitely not, super proficient like these guys are, but they're entertaining. And yeah, I don't think they're all kooks. I think they definitely, they have the right idea on some things, like be prepared and take care of yourself and don't be stupid and you'll probably survive. Actually one of my favorite,
that's a big one.
Yeah.
That's like the big one is just like, yeah, be able to take care of yourself. Like have some water backed up, have some extra fuel, keep gas in your car, which I never do. And don't be an idiot is pretty much like the
yeah, it's the code of the Hurricane Alley. Like, just don't be stupid. And you know, when Hurricane Harvey hit, that was my first hurricane. I've lived in Texas 10 years in Houston area, and I came right after Hurricane Ike. So I'd never seen one until Harvey, and I didn't even know what to do or expect. And I thought like, oh, I'll be fine. Like, I know I'm not dumb. I'll get some water. I got some canned food. I've got candles. I've got, you know, flashlights, I'll be all right. And then when all that flood water hit, I didn't know what the hell to do. I'm like, I'm scared to death. I've never been this scared in my life, and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get out of here, and I don't know how I would even remotely try to get out of here. So, I mean, I think what you think you can do versus what you will do versus what you think you should do are all very different things. And when you have an emergency, you kind of get faced with that. And that's the fun part of writing about an apocalypse. Some people make that happen and some people don't make that happen. And that's always right. the fun part. You know, I think if you read The Stand, so the big fat long version of The Stand, there's like a whole chapter or two chapters where people just didn't make it, not because they got Captain Trips and got sick, but because they did something dumb, like got on a ladder and broke their ankle and then no one was around to help them. Or like little kids getting left by themselves and the little kid eats poison or something. I mean, Stephen King didn't pull any punches on that stuff. Like, he was like, yeah, some people aren't going to make it even though they made it. Yeah. And I really love that chapter.
That's one good thing about Stephen King. That was another one. I don't know if I'm sure you've read On Writing, but when he talks about when he's getting like protest mail because of the the main antagonist in the Dead Zone, like the politician guy that starts the end of the world. He's like flashes back to whenever he's like a traveling salesman and a dog runs out and he kicks the dog to death. And it's like people are like animal rights groups are protesting him. And Stephen King's like, okay, well, first of all, yeah, at first he's like starting to write like, I'm sorry. He's like, wait. He's like, the town didn't exist. The dog didn't exist. The guy who kicked the dog didn't exist. It's all just words on a page.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not apologizing for that. That's what makes him scary. I think I did a good job.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, too. You know, especially as if you write horror, you know, you're going to come to a point where you're going to write something violent against, you know, an animal or a kid. It's how you handle it. It's why you did it. It's important. I mean, I don't know that I can ever... Right. I did write some animal violence once and everybody was like, I can't believe you wrote that. I'm like, yeah, me neither. So, even though, I mean, I would have killed that cat like 10 minutes ago, but it's, you know, it's a cat. So he's deserved it 10 times over. But I mean, it's hard. Like I don't like writing, you know, animal torture or anything like that. And I certainly don't want to write abuse against children, but where does horror come from? Horror comes from the things that make us uncomfortable and upset us. So sometimes you have to go there. You just have to go there with skill. I actually remember, so when I started writing with Jay, we would go to like Denny's and write on Thursday nights. And I remember when she was writing Crone and she had a hard time trying to envision how to write some scenes of maybe like abuse or not really even write them, but like she knew she had to have it in her mind about how this happened because it was important to the story, but she wanted to be really careful and respectful about the way she wrote, you know, all of it. And I that always stuck with me that she was like that. I mean, and everybody who's a good writer, I think is like that. Like you don't write things to just, I think I'll write something terrible and gross sometimes maybe, but it has to have a point. It has to have a point in your story and drive your story forward. So
I agree. Well, it's the same thing. Like I used to know these guys who used to write songs and like, oh, we're a heavy metal band. And like, oh, when their lyrics were all like, you know, blood and guts and blood and guts and blood. And it's like, okay, look, that's, you know, like that's not really good writing, guys.
It's not good writing. Like, and it's not a song like I'm going to want to listen to more than once. You know,
Yeah, so, I mean, like, you read a book and it's or a story or whatever, and you're like, oh, man, you know, it's like, that's devastating. That's impactful. And it has to come from a place of reality. I mean, I think if you're being honest in your writing, that you're always pretty safe. You know, it's even when it comes to tropes, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, well, it's like, I have a hard time sometimes with reading certain I want to say it was a review or somebody was like, it's like so-and-so doesn't have enough, you know, strong female characters. And it's like, well, that's because all of the female characters were victims of the bad guy until like the final girl came out of her shell and kicked his ass. Like how many strong, like the whole point of her becoming who she was the fact that all these others got knocked down along the way and she saw it happening and had to step forward. Like this is an arc, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can't like in horror movies, like a Friday the 13th or which is a bad example, but even a Halloween where it's like, well, yeah, the movie is called The Babysitter Killer.
The
Babysitter Murders. Like you can only really have one final girl. The others are fodder for the story, and it's not misogynistic. It's frightening because you don't want that motherfucker in your house,
killing
your kid or your sister or your girlfriend or whatever. It's like that's what makes it scary.
I never have a problem with that. So I mean, I'm all about a strong female character, but I mean, like when I watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, all of the people in that are so annoying. You're like, oh my God, I can't wait for them to kill you and eat you or whatever they're going to do. Like the brother's annoying. The friends are annoying. All of them are like, oh my God, I cannot wait until this hillbilly family kills all of y'all. So in the end, like she's badass and she's not even that competent either. Right. Like she's like, I'm screwed up. We all screwed up. This is a terrible thing. And she just barely gets away. So, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. It's the story. And in Halloween, I mean, Laurie Strode's kind of a badass. Like, I think she's a badass. And I just saw, I just saw that last Halloween where she's like all paranoid prepper and
see,
like,
I thought that was great.
Yeah, that's my favorite part of it. I love that movie. I was like, get to it. And like anything with Michael Myers, like, I mean, the dude gets shot point blank. Like, he's a human. Like, there's not anything supernatural about him, except he's just focused and crazy. So,
yeah,
you know, that's a little, I guess you got to suspend some disbelief, but you got to wait until the end when, you know, he gets what's coming to him, maybe.
And
Jamie Lee Curtis is just a badass in that movie. She's so much fun to watch. And I enjoyed that part of it. You know, the teen parts and the boyfriends and all that stupid, but that's just part of the genre. Like, you're going to have that. It's part of the genre. You can love other parts of it and you can hate that part and move on with life. But that's all slasher movies. Like, you're watching them for the fun kills. And, you know, you mentioned Friday the 13th, like, that has some of my favorite kills ever. Like, when he picks up the sleeping bag with the girl in it, whacks her against the tree. I'm like, that's hilarious. That was funny. And it's not, you know,
yeah.
I'm sorry. You beat a woman to death against a tree. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying that that's why I'm watching it, for the funness of the kills. And that was a pretty fun kill.
That's one of those things with like the Friday the 13th. And I said, that's probably a bad example, because the creators of the series were like, basically, if they had a heart, like a good solid opening, the phone call came. It's like, okay, make another one. And they were low budget.
Yeah.
And they hired actors that they didn't even care if they could even say lines. And if the acting was bad enough, they just killed them earlier in the story.
Yeah.
Like, it was just to have a bunch of kills. But yeah, you don't watch a Friday the 13th movie to be like, To get a sense of social justice, I guess, and it's not to say that in any kind of tongue in cheek way, but kind of the whole point is he's killing folks. But one thing about it that's been noted by a lot of people who tend to get upset at these things is that Jason's body count's pretty even, male to female. Like, he kills just as many dudes, and he kills a lot of animals too.
Yeah,
and, like,
whatever's so, in his way, whatever's in his yeah. way is gonna die. That's death.
But like
he
you say,
is
you
death.
Know, whenever he picks up the girl and smacks her in the sleeping bag, I guess, you know, if anybody's like, oh, well, you know, that's a rough way to go out. It's like, well, he was going to kill her anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, at least, you know, she had this bag zipped up over her head and couldn't really see. And, you know, it just kind of ended.
What way would you prefer? His, you know, stabbing or the arrow in the eye or what? Like, or a whack against a tree? That was probably faster. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's part of the fun of it. And it's a different kind of horror. So not all horror is the same. And you don't watch that movie for the same reasons that you would watch like an Ari Aster movie. So if you're going to watch Midsommar. So I saw Midsommar this summer and I loved it. But it's not the same kind of movie. It's not the same kind of horror movie. And everybody likes what they like. Some people really love slasher stuff. Some people really love cerebral horror. Some people like body horror. Some people like weird, you know, splatterpunk stuff. I mean, just it depends on what you like, and all of it has value. But you know, you just gotta take it for what it is and not judge one part of the genre based on the other part of the genre. Just let it be what it is,
right?
And like it or don't, and that's all, you know.
Well, I love the whole thing. I like the writing. I like the movies. I like books, short stories, magazines. I picked up a bunch of old Fangorias not too long ago, and I've been reading reviews and reading how like The Shining was absolutely hated by everybody. And in like the early 80s, they're like, this is the worst movie ever. Like, no way. Like, horribly reviewed. And everybody, it's like number one on the top 10 list of everybody's least favorite movie of the year. It's like, well... And then everything that everybody liked is stuff you've never even heard of. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, I love The Shining, and I remember being like in high school and watching that with friends, and it had been out for a while. I mean, that was the early 80s that came out, late 70s. And I was watching it in the 90s, and it was like the it thing to watch. Like, oh, you'll be tripped out by watching The Shining. And I'm like, it is trippy, like, because it's a Stanley Kubrick movie, so it's definitely... weird and visually stunning, and you know, not at all like that book, not at all like the book, but you know, significantly different than that book. So It's definitely different. And a lot of people, that's their favorite horror movie. And I guess there's some people that they hate it and it's their worst. But it is what it is. And you like it or you don't. Like, he was a maverick filmmaker. He made weird movies. It fits horror for me, right? Like, so, you know, I hadn't seen Hellraiser until recently, like the first one. And I was struck by the visual stunningness of Hellraiser and the fact that it's actually a love story. It's not horror right. until like the end of it, other than the killing people, but it's a love story, right? So it's first and foremost a love story and second, a horror story. And that's pretty much Clive Barker, I would say, from the Clive Barker that I've read.
It's like, yeah.
That's how he approaches horror.
I haven't
horror.
Seen Hellraiser in a long time. I'm not super big on the body horror type stuff. Like, I mean, I've obviously seen the Hellraiser movies and it's like, okay, you know, stick that feather in my hat for having seen it, but I'm not like, ooh, drawn to it. I'm gonna, you know, I'm not going to throw on a Hellraiser marathon. That's just going to make me sad. Like, I just kind of grossed out and like, ugh, that dude's got no skin. No good. But,
yeah, I mean, like, it's real twisted and gross. So that makes it fun. But also, like, it's, you know, she loves him. He came back from a hell dimension. So, you know, love conquers all.
So are you going to go see it?
I saw it last Friday night. Yeah, I saw it. Yeah. I liked it. I thought that the scenes with the adults were really well done. They did I think almost seamless job of matching up the kids to the adult. There was not one of them where I was like, I don't see that. That doesn't make sense. Or the adults mm-hmm. didn't act like the kids acted in the first movie. So I enjoyed it. I mean, like, the monster scenes are spot on for me as far as being weird and gross and awesome. And the performances are really good of all the adults. So I really liked it. I thought it was a little bit long. Not everybody agrees with me. They're like, oh no, it was just long enough. I'm like, eh. I kind of had to pee, so, and I might have had some margaritas beforehand, so I kind of was in a place where I needed to pee. But it was good. I really liked it, and I'm excited to put them both together at some point and watch them, like, old school long style. So
nice. Yeah, I'm looking for a chance when I can get out there and see it, because it's
tough. You got kids, so you got to like balance all that stuff out.
I got kids and like. Yeah, I was supposed to go camping this last weekend, and I realized, like, hey, it's probably not a good idea this close to the event to be out of pocket for 3 days. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to go. And then, like, literally all weekend I was busy, like, taking care of business. And I was just like, man, that was a really smart idea to yeah. not go on that trip. Plus it was 100 degrees, but that was only secondary.
Yeah.
But I think we're probably nearing the end of our time. So other than the Halloween show coming up and the Hard yeah. Truth on October 3rd, what else do we have going on?
October is like my busy month, usually May and October, because lots of shows and stuff. So we'll be doing the Scary Dads. I'm excited for that. Cannot wait for that. And then in a couple weeks after that, I'm going to be in Galveston Island at a book festival out there. So, you know, literature and whatnot. So be doing that. That's exciting. And then, I mean, I'm always excited for Halloween because that's my favorite time of year. So I'm excited to get my costume ready and just have fun. So, but, awesome. Yeah.
Well, same over here. We got the Halloween show going on, and then I'm going to take a little bit of a nap, and then we've got our Halloween party here at the house, which is in the last year or so has turned into a neighborhood Halloween party, which has been pretty cool. And then we're just full speed into the holidays, and I'm yeah. going to try the best I can to take a back seat into the holidays so that I'm not like running everything. And then yeah. I'm going to come out, you know, pretty short on the heels of part 3 and book space for part 4, because there's no rest for the wicked here.
There's not. But there's not.
But I really appreciate you coming on. Had a good time chatting, and we will see you soon. And guys, pick up Jessica's new book on October 3rd, The Hard Truth, and there will be links in the show notes and on the website. And until next time, keep it scary.